Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker. Today's episode is sponsored by BetBright, the home of the 10 million weekly challenge for the duration of the World Cup. My name's Thomas Rooney and I'm delighted to be joined by Mohammed Butt, the chief writer at Squawker. How's it going, mate?
It's pretty good. We're still World Cupping. Very, very good World Cup here, but we'll have to get less games now, so it's a bit more time to wait.
Absolutely. And Jake Entwistle, the assistant editor at Squawker. How's it going, Jake? World Cup fever still right.
I was going to say, similar feeling, though, that it's sort of the blur between happiness and sadness, that it's all over soon. It could be over in the best way possible.
And also, we've got Peter Welch from BetBright. How's it going, Peter? How you doing, mate?
How are you?
It's good to have you with us. I was just wondering, just the first word before we crack on with looking ahead to the semi-finals, just looking at England's odds to win the tournament. It's incredibly short compared to what they were at the start of the tournament. And is everyone getting behind England as they get to the latter stages?
Well, it's unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, 3 or 4 weeks ago, if you would have said that we've got a semi-final place against Croatia, we'd have bitten your hand off. We probably wouldn't quite have believed you. So we've gone from a sort of state of disbelief to now being 5-2, second favourites behind France, who are 2-1.
Crazy.
Belgium, they're 11-4. Obviously, they play each other, so therefore Belgium slightly longer just compared to England. But yeah, 5-2, England to go all the way and take football home. So unbelievable, really.
Yeah, it's been incredible.
Compare that to what people thought our chances were 3 or 4 weeks ago. It's quite phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of joked about England going all the way at one point, so the fact that it's a genuine reality now is insane.
You may say it's a joke.
Yeah. Hey, Jake and I, and I bet you, producer, if we can just go back and look at this pod before the World Cup, Jake and I said that England will make the semi-finals of the World Cup, and everyone was like, what? And we were like, well, you wait and see.
And just on that subject, obviously it's the first time since 1990 that England have made a semi-final.
Yeah.
Jake, I'll start with you talking about the fact that England have made it this far. How big an achievement is it? Because the people are going, oh, they've only played Colombia, you know, they've played all these teams that aren't one of the top draw teams. Like, we thought we'd have to beat Brazil in the quarterfinal, we had to beat Sweden. So how big an achievement do you think it is? And I think it's got to be all credit to the guys, hasn't it?
Considering we've lost to Iceland at the last major tournament that we played in and let Costa Rica top a group in the World Cup previously, I think being actually beating these teams should be a massive positive. Whether you consider them to be bad teams or not, England have been in the bracket of bad team at every major tournament since about 1990, really. Mm. In the 2000s especially, we've not really gone far and we've never really impressed when we have gone sort of far. And now in this tournament, we've got the furthest we have for a long while and we actually look good when we play. If beating Panama and Tunisia, although Tunisia was only 2-1, that was the best game we sort of played. We looked really good, should have scored more. And then we scored 6 against Panama. That never happened at a World Cup for England ever before. Was it 1-0 against Trinidad and Tobago when we played them?
Yeah, straight through, didn't we?
It was 1-0 against Ecuador in one of the last quarterfinals we played, thanks to a David Beckham free kick. So trying to sort of devalue the England's progress in this tournament by the quality of opposition doesn't make any sense to me, because we've played this level of opposition previously and struggled against it. So the fact England are playing well, and we comfortably beat Sweden, if not for agreeably Jordan Pickford made some brilliant saves in that game, and maybe that would have been different if one of those slipped through. But even that in itself, having a goalkeeper that saves shots is something that England haven't had for a while. So this tournament, yeah, we've got through to the semi-final. We may have not played the best teams yet, but you shouldn't devalue the performance, because we have massively struggled against these teams before and even been knocked out by them. So for me, it's a massive achievement, and semi-final, no matter who you play, means you've done something right, and England have done something right and something different than before.
Yeah, I mean, you look at it, right, since 1990, okay, so we weren't at 94. 98... quarterfinals against Argentina. All right, you know, you lose that game. It's a penalty shootout. Argentina, a very, very good side. Lots of great players. England, really lucky to take it to penalties as they were, you know, with the Marco Lam wonder goal. 2002, lose to Brazil quarterfinals. Again, you're sort of saying, yeah, okay, you can't argue that. England were never going to, even though Brazil went down to 10 men, that was a phenomenal Brazil side. Very hard, very well drawn. 2010, again, Germany semi round 16. You're thinking, yeah, fair enough. That's a very good German side. Maybe England could have done a bit better. Maybe if Lampard's goal had counted, it would have been different. But that was a good German team. It was a very solid German team. But you look at 2006, you look at 2014, there's no, you know, this is England, like Jake says, England have played easy teams before. They've played beatable teams before. 2006, that was not. Portugal in 2004 were very good. 2006, they weren't that great. They finished third, but they finished fourth, and they were a distant fourth behind Germany, and Italy and France. Like, England should have beaten them. Let's be honest, right? I know everyone likes to blame Rooney, but England should have beaten them and should have won that game. They should have had that game wrapped up before Rooney got red carded. You know, underachievement. Even Ericsson, before the Sweden game, the BBC, I think it was, did interviewed Ericsson, and he was like, yeah, in 2006, we should have done better. We should have done better. And they should have done. And 2014, I mean, you know, Uruguay weren't at their best. I know Suarez had a really good game against England, but Uruguay weren't at their best. Italy were not their best. Costa Rica were defensively solid, but were not especially brilliant. Now they got to a quarterfinal, and that was incredible for them. But again, England should have done better than they did. And it's just the fact that executing on your ability, even if it's against lesser teams, is still something that a lot of teams in football, a lot of teams in all kinds of football, especially international football, don't do. Mm. Like, just beating teams you should beat. It's something you can struggle with. Look at Germany this year, right? Germany were better objectively in terms of individual talent than all three of the teams they played, right? They only beat Sweden thanks to a last minute goal, and even then they got lucky that Bertin didn't get sent off in the first half, you know, for a penalty. So they got out, they didn't beat Korea, they didn't beat Mexico, they got outplayed by both teams. So just beating teams you should beat is still something commendable to be said. Like Jake says, if you made to a semi-final, you've done so. I would say even more than one thing, right? You don't want two things, right? You know, and I think England have, look, Tunisia, there was a tweet, I can't remember who said it now, so I apologize to that, but there was someone tweeted something like, you can just imagine what might have been, you know, Sam Allardyce's England scrapes a 1-1 against Tunisia, beats Panama 1-0 with a Rooney penalty, and it's like, after the Tunisia debacle, just glad to be in it by going into the Belgian game, thanks to a man of the match performance from JT.
Yeah,
and you can honestly, that's a brilliant tweet, because honestly, that's so realistic. You can see that happening. Yeah. Like, England getting smashed by Tunisia on the break because they're failing to break them down, and then playing terribly against Panama, winning with a one goal or something, and then going to the final against Belgium, needing to win something, and maybe doing it, maybe not.
I mean, Jordan Pickford wouldn't be in goal, would he?
Well, no, Jordan Pickford would have been goal. There's no way that John Stones wouldn't be in defence. Jordan Henderson wouldn't be defensive midfield. Wayne Rooney would be in there somewhere. Jesse Lingard would be nowhere near the team. Raheem Sterling would have been dropped 5 seconds into the first game. You know, it would have been so different. The team would look different. The team would have played different. The team would have had different results. Gutting out the win against Tunisia, like they did with those excellent set pieces, was huge.
Yeah.
Huge. And then blowing, I mean, they didn't play brilliantly against Panama, but blowing Panama away with the efficiency that England did was also huge. Those two, like Jake said, that doesn't happen for England at tournaments. Gutting out last minute wins, blowing away a team that should be blown away. And the Belgium game, all right, whatever. Look,
and as well, winning a penalty shootout.
Yeah, and that's what I was about to get to. Winning a penalty shootout. Like, because if you watch that game, you watch that shootout, you watch the game, you're thinking, okay, England are a better team than Colombia because James Rodriguez wasn't playing. Okay, so England, and we'll get onto that later in a minute, but James Rodriguez wasn't playing. England were better than Colombia. Should have won the game reasonably more comfortably than they did. Maybe Southgate didn't make the best subs, didn't bring on Rashford when he should have done earlier in the game, whatever, right? And then Iomina equalises last second. And you're thinking, oh dear. And then extra time, Colombia are miles better than England. And you're thinking, oh God, here it is again. Yeah. Shootout? No. Nerves. I mean, look, they looked like they were nervous in extra time. They looked like they were petrified of making a mistake, of doing something wrong. And you're thinking, okay, this is not going to work. But when it got to the shootout, Southgate has said he made it a technical exercise, not a mental one, and always worked on them when they were tired. After long training sessions, they're exhausted. Okay, now you go practice penalties. Because you can't simulate the crowd, but you can simulate being fatigued. And then, excellent in the penalty shootout. Excellent.
And Peter, Three Lines is number one in the charts. England are in the semi-finals. Are you enjoying the ride?
I'm absolutely loving it. It's one of those where you come in at the start of the tournament, as I said, very low expectations, just excited to see a young, attacking, kind of unknown England side, seeing how they can do and trying to mix it with the best. So far, as you say, we haven't really come up against one of the traditionally best sides. But again, it's just nice to see the lads express themselves and again win a penalty shootout, which I haven't seen in my lifetime, which is something to behold in itself. Of course, the draw has been kind, and it's the old cliche of only playing what's in front of you. So I think the fans are aware of the fact that we've rolled our luck a little bit in terms of the draw and who's in front of us to play. And the whole way, as you said, the it's coming home mania is almost like a tongue-in-cheek expression of disbelief that we've got this far. As you say, you've got to do things right to get to the semi-finals. But I think we've been a little bit lucky in terms of who we've come up against so far. But I think saying that 13-10 tomorrow, England to beat Croatia in normal time, I think that's a fair price. I think we go into it sort of the righteous favourites.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that's certainly reflected in sort of the way people are feeling. I mean, we're coming through all the tests we've had so far. Why not another one? And I suppose regardless of what happens, though, this World Cup's been a success for Southgate's England, hasn't it?
Oh, an enormous success. This is, I mean, because you can see with the way the squad was selected, they're targeting 2022. Yeah. You can tell. I mean, all the squad is in their early 20s, so they'll be in their late 20s in 2022. Perfect age for coming around and doing it. The only player who's really, you're not going to be involved is Cahill and Vardy, and they're fringe players. So
yeah, they don't play much anyway.
Exactly. The starting team is all, I think, except maybe Henderson. I think it's all in their mid to early 20s, right? So they will all be there in 2022. This is clearly, this was like, okay, let's just have a good tournament. Let's play well. Let's get the lads used to playing in this kind of environment. Let's get them bonding, you know. And they were not, the fact they've got this far, I thought they could always do it, but the fact they've got this far against a team that they can now beat, that's impressive. This is a huge, huge early, it's come too soon for England in the sense that this is way before schedule, but it's in a good way. They don't look like they're like a team that gets promoted too quickly and is like, oh God, what have we done? And they get smashed. Yeah. It doesn't look like that's going to happen to England because
And also they've been winning tournaments sort of at different age groups as well. So there is some very good young players beyond these guys.
Just about to say that. I completely agree with Mo's point there that it's sort of exceeded expectations, but England have not done this by fluke in the same way that Germany were brilliant in 2010 but didn't win it and then won it in 2014. Mm. Again, I'm not saying that it would be too soon to say that we're going to win the World Cup in 2022, but that sort of structure has been put in place. You dominate every single youth level tournament that you play at and you produce a first team side that has potential in 4 years' time to be at their peak of their powers. And getting to a semi-final is a complete bonus. It gives you that experience of going that far in a tournament. But I believe the aim for this squad, and as Mo said again, the squad will be very much the same nearly in 2022, plus or minus the likes of Jadon Sancho and some brilliant teenagers that will be the Rashfords of the 2022 squad.
Yeah. I mean, imagine this team with Ryan Sessegnon left wing back. That's all I'm saying.
4 years older, incredible. Obviously,
he's
the next
more of a forward. I'll leave that one for now.
We'll discuss that in 2022.
Yeah.
In terms of the next test, Croatia, probably the toughest test because you can't really count the Belgium game because that was pretty much a friendly. Who do you think has been more impressive, England or Croatia? Because Croatia, impressive against Argentina, but Argentina were terrible. Yes. And then they've been taken to sort of penalties a couple of times.
It's tiered for me, right? There's three layers to this, okay? Rakitic and Modric have been very impressive. Then it's England, and then it's the rest of Croatia. And the rest of Croatia are way behind. Well, maybe Subasic as well. Mm. But then the rest of Croatia, after Rakitic, Modric, Subasic are way behind. Those two world-class players, Subasic had a brilliant tournament, amazing tournament. Rest of Croatia, they've not looked very good. This is the thing with Croatia, right? They have a wonderful team structure, which makes them look very nice. And they'll have two world-class midfielders. When you have world-class midfielders, everyone else in your team looks good, right? But they have world-class midfielders and they have a great structure. When they play 4-2-3, when they play 4-2-3-1, they look terrible, by the way. And that's why for an hour against Russia, they played 4-2-3-1, Rakitic and Modric at the base. Look garbage. Mm. And then they brought Brozovic on and suddenly they looked like a football team again. Rakitic and Modric had room to move into. Rakitic was playing excellent positional play. Modric was dominating the ball. Phenomenal, phenomenal stuff. But their wingers are so inconsistent moment to moment. Like, you can't even, like, man, Perisic is so inconsistent. He's inconsistent in games. Like, for 5 minutes spell, he'll look world-class, and for 10 minutes, he'll look rubbish. And Rebic is just like a mardy wind-up merchant who occasionally does great things with the ball. They're so inconsistent. And Mandzukic is, everyone always talks about how he's the ideal kind of striker, but if you've got like a support striker that's always going to be up there running in behind him. If he's just playing up front by himself, he's constantly moving all over the place, coming deep, and there's no one in the box. He's coming. I mean, even the goal against that's why he works when there's 4-2-3 and when they play Kramaric, because that's why they play Kramaric, because it's like, okay, Mandzukic is just going to run wherever the hell he wants to go to press the ball, to look for the ball. He's no positional discipline. So then you need someone who actually is going to be in the box. That's why Juve have been playing left wing, because it's like, okay, you can run and get involved in the ball and, you know, use the ball and play your football and then also get in the box occasionally. Whereas, and that's, so that's what I think is going to be Mandzukic. That's the thing with Croatia. Their structure is good, but their players just, I mean, their defence is terrible. And let's get back to that, because their defence is, Vida is ropey. Now they've got to, with Vasalko out, they've got to put, Vidran Čorluka in the defence. Like, And I mean, Jake's going to go, I'm not going to touch the left back because I want Jake to go off on the left back because he's got some great go for it, Jake. It's just
I just think, well, the fact that Strinic got hauled off against Russia, like, you know, you're playing badly if that's a game where you're getting taken off. So there's definitely space to exploit there. But just in terms of like their actual, how impressive they've been, they beat Nigeria. The comments after that game were, Nigeria have just put in the worst World Cup display of everyone has seen in a while. Croatia weren't good. Yeah. Everyone was like, this Nigeria team were bad. And obviously Nigeria then picked it up and looked really good.
Yeah.
But against Argentina. Yeah. Hold on.
It was a pattern.
Is it because Argentina are bad? Probably. Argentina weren't impressive and they won 3-0 in that game. The first goal was obviously that complete error by Caballero. So that set the tone and Argentina looked rattled from that moment onwards. The world-class talent that they have meant that Croatia could take advantage of that. No one is... I'm not saying they're not impressive in that. Modric and Rakitic have claims to be in sort of team of the tournament territory. They have been good. But Croatia as a team, and then they beat Iceland in the last game with a last-minute Perisic goal. So, again, England couldn't beat Iceland 2 years ago. That I'm not taking away from that. Mm. But in terms of being impressive, two long, drawn-out, quite boring slogs that went to a shootout...
Mm.
Doesn't paint you in a great light. So, again, you can't knock Croatia for getting to the semi-final. Rakitic taking two final penalties win the game. That is something commendable. Mm. Subasic is only the third goalkeeper in World Cup history to save four shootout penalties. And he's done it in a single tournament. If he saves another... Like, if England go to a penalty shootout, Croatia have won two. That's now second nature to them. That's their strength. Mm. They have the ability and the players to keep the ball and sort of not really threaten, but not look threatened because of the class they have in midfield. So this Croatia game could be really dodgy for England in the sense that this, although Croatia might be knackered after playing 240 minutes of football, they're almost sort of like coasting in that now. That's what they're used to. Whereas England will need to sort of, as we said, we need to take advantage of these weaknesses that they have.
Peter, in this term, could you remind us of the match odds for the game and whether you think England have much to fear in Croatia from what you've seen so far?
Yeah, so starting with the odds for the game, Croatia 5-2. We've got the draw at 21-10, and England 13-10. But then you talk about penalties and extra time, and the amount of extra time that Croatia have played getting to this stage. Croatia 13-10 to qualify. England the favourites there 8-13. So I think the betting there reflects kind of the nation's hopes and sort of almost cautions going into the game. I think you're right. Croatia's win against Argentina was impressive, but this was a broken Argentina side, so we can't forget that. And also the fact that they couldn't beat Denmark or Russia in normal or extra time. So, yes, this will be England's toughest test so far, I think, but we've also got to remember these are no footballing giants, so we have to respect the quality that's in the Croatian side. But if you ask me, England have absolutely nothing to fear. We've obviously had a relatively straightforward quarterfinal against Sweden over the weekend, which was that came after a testing enough 120 minutes against Colombia with the shootout win. I think England will be going into this full of confidence. And I think the odds there of England 13-10 are fair. I think hopefully the lads will prove the price is right.
Absolutely.
I think for me, what's really important for England going into the game is that they establish a Trippier and Young very early on, because Denmark showed, and it was a brilliant switch when they brought in Lasse Schürrle at half time. If you can attack with the wings effectively, because Perisic and Rebic are defensively responsible, they'll come back and defend if you attack through the wings. And when you do that, Mandzukic is like way on his own. There's no one anywhere near him, and then he's going to come deep to get the ball. And then what's going to happen is Croatia just going to have nothing in attack. So if I'm Southgate, immediately what I do is I go wide, even if it's not going to lead to anything. I go wide, I send crosses in, and I pull those fullbacks back, those wingers back, sorry. Because once those wingers are back, Mandzukic is on his own, he's going to be much easier to deal with. And then what you can start doing is you can start sending one of Walker or Maguire forward into midfield, helping boost midfield. And then that's going to help protect against Rakitic and Modric, who are the danger men. So establish the wide players really quickly. Pin the Croatian wingers back, isolate Mandzukic, and then send one of your midfielders forward to help. Send one of your centre backs forward. I would send Maguire forward. Send him forward to help sort of contest with Rakitic and Modric, because those two are the ones that could turn the game in a moment of genius.
If you get Modric, if Modric turns your midfield, that's when England will be worried. his sort of game against Russia, in the 90 minutes, he wasn't brilliant. He was obviously Modric, and he's a 7 out of 10 pretty much every game he plays because he's that good. But extra time, he was incredible. And for a player to be better after they've played 90 minutes is testament to his not only his fitness, but his ability. And in that game, he completed 8 dribbles, which is the most by a sort of a central midfielder in the tournament in a single game so far. Obviously, he played extra minutes, but you shouldn't take away from that. And if you let Modric turn you and exploit those tired legs, I'm worried about Henderson coming up against Rakitic and Modric, because in Dele Alli and Jesse Lingard at the moment, it is very much his defensive responsibility. Yeah. Lingard and Dele will contest challenges for sure. They've not been irresponsible in their role, but you wouldn't favour them against sort of these two experienced midfield, like they are midfield maestros, aren't they? They play for two of the best clubs in the world, and they're a key part in two of those clubs. So that midfield battle, the longer it goes on, the more I'm concerned I'm going to get. And I don't think bringing Eric Dier in would help that, because I just still think they're not... We can't match Modric and Rakitic man for man in terms of world-class midfield ability.
That's very true.
So, again, Mo's point about letting Maguire and Walker engage that and just stopping them from turning. Don't let Modric get his turn and get his head up. If Henderson is the one to engage whichever midfielder gets the ball, make sure Maguire is there afterwards just to clean him out if he does turn it. Because getting past two people in a row is difficult. But if you let him just spin Henderson and let him bear down on our three centre-backs, that's the worry. And Mandzukic, for his size and for everything he is, Mo's touched on it, his movement's very good. So if they do escape that sort of midfield area, then you would be worried. And Perisic as well, yes, he's very inconsistent, but this guy is completely two-footed and is capable of scoring from 40 yards. So the more space they get in behind that first midfield area, the more danger it would be. But I think England have the tools to stop it. I just think we need to be very aware that that is where they'll cause us trouble. And make sure, as again, I agree with Mo, make sure that Trippier sees a lot of the ball.
Yeah, getting Modric spinning, and then Rakitic, his positional play against Russia and Denmark was just off the charts. Against Russia, when they went to 4-3-3, Rakitic was just constantly finding these pockets of space. They weren't passing him the ball for some reason, but he was constantly like in 5-10 yards of space ahead of the Russian defence. If they'd given him the ball more often, he would have killed them. And that's you don't want him doing that with Modric spinning Henderson. Modric spins Henderson, Rakitic is in that position, you're in trouble. So it's just about stopping those two, but doing it within the formation. I think there's the rumour of Henderson, he's got a hamstring problem, not 100% fit. I wouldn't play him. I wouldn't bring Dier in, because I agree with Jake. I don't think Dier bringing in a blocker is really the answer. And I do think Dier, he was so bad against Belgium, and you worry. I mean, he wasn't good against
Colombia, was he?
No, he wasn't either. That's the thing. Was awful. Good penalty, but you're just sort of worried. But like, you don't want him bringing that sort of form into it. I would play Fabian Delph personally.
Delph's sort of. He's known for that stamina. And
he basically played defensive midfield for Man City. I mean, he was left back, but it was basically defensive midfield all season. He can play there. He's experienced. He's mobile. He's very happy because he was allowed to go home to witness the birth of his daughter, which I thought was brilliant from Southgate. Let him go home for 5 days. Brought him back. He's seen what the mood of the country is. I would play Delph and I would wrap Henderson in cotton wool and bandages and heat packs for the final if England get there.
I think the one thing that England need to look out for is when the team sheets are announced, if Croatia have Brozovic in the team, then you should be more concerned. If the only centre midfielders that you can see is Modric and Rakitic, then you just take a sigh of relief. They're not going to be as effective. After 60 minutes, Brozovic came on against Russia. Hold on, Modric and Rakitic have been unshackled here. But if Croatia don't include that third central midfielder to help bolster Modric and Rakitic, then England can sort of take advantage of that.
Just to round it off, it's prediction time, boys. So you've got 5 seconds to
come with.
Peter, we'll come for you first. Do you think England are going to do it?
Thanks, guys. I think I do, actually. Yeah, I do. As I said, it's going to be our toughest contest yet. Whether it will take 90 minutes, 120 minutes, I'm not sure. I'd like to go for it's one of those, isn't it? It could be anything. So I'm going to go for 2-1.
2-1 to England.
11-1 with Betbright.
Excellent. What are you going for, Jake?
If it goes to extra time, I think we'll lose. But I think we will beat them in normal time. 2-0. a similar Sweden thing.
All right, I'm going to say 3-1 England. I'll tell you how it's going to happen as well. Harry Maguire is going to score, or John Stones is going to score from a set piece, right? Or it's someone. Basically, England have a corner, they're going to score, right? It's going to be 1-0. All right, and then Croatia are going to start pushing bodies forward, right? England are going to hit them on a break. It's going to be the Raheem Sterling first of the tournament or Jesse Lingard 2-0, right? And then everyone's going to be like, oh, ha-ha, England are going to start coasting, right? Then Croatia are going to get one back and everyone's going to panic. Everyone's going to be like, ah, oh, no! And it's going to, Croatia are going to be battering England. And then right at the end, counter-attack, Raheem Sterling falls over, gets fouled. Harry Kane, cool penalty, kills the game. England in the final.
Peter, have you got 3-1 England there? Maybe not specific as Mo points out, but have you got 3-1 England anywhere? Sorry, say that again?
What score did he predict there?
3-1 to England.
3-1,
20-1.
There we go.
I love the 20-1s. I wish everything I pick is
so you just pluck 21s out of nowhere.
Yes. Apparently, everything I pick is like 21.
We're certainly looking forward to it. England versus Croatia, Wednesday at 7 p.m. Bring it on. Okay, next up, Tuesday evening, we have the first semi-final, France versus Belgium. First question is kind of, again, what you're expecting from the game, Jake, and who would England rather face? There's two questions in one there, so... First of all, the game itself, are you looking forward to it?
Yes, very much looking forward to it, because I think the weaknesses and strengths pair up in terms of where France want to play. Belgium have looked shaky. What Belgium want to do, I think, is what France should be scared of. I can see it going a similar way to that Brazil game. France will have more of the ball because Belgium are... not just happy to give away possession, they want that to happen because they've got the most lightning counter-attack at the World Cup. I wouldn't be surprised to see them employ that sort of Everton throwback again, mm-hmm. with Lukaku starting out wide and De Bruyne being central. I think as good as Dries Mertens has been for Napoli in the past two seasons, De Bruyne proved that, oh wait, we need this guy further forward. You can't pin him back and give him defensive responsibility. Not because he can't do it, but because the damage he can cause when he is in that sort of centre forward position was sort of irreparable, mm-hmm. and just ask Brazil what they think of De Bruyne after that game. Yeah, so I think Martinez, although it was sort of maybe a surprise tactic against Brazil, they weren't expecting, I think he will employ something similar. Eden Hazard is obviously, in my eyes, probably now the sort of best dribbler in the world in terms of being able to just turn and carry the ball. Lionel Messi, I don't think, should be compared to him because that's just an otherworldly person that can take the ball and everyone knows what he can do. But Eden Hazard, in that game, completed 10 out of 10 take-ons. Not only is that the most take-ons in a game by a person, again, I'm bringing out my favourite stat, but so 100% of that. And then Optijo, using their database, they managed to go back. And since 1966, since they've been collecting data, Eden Hazard's 10 dribbles was the most... with 100% completion rate in sort of their World Cup data history. So Belgium have got the most lethal counter-attack because they've got one of the most creative minds at the World Cup. Mm-hmm. They've got the best dribbler and carrier of the ball at the World Cup left. And they've got one of the most intelligent strikers at the World Cup in Lukaku. And I think what speaks volumes about them is that every game, Romelu Lukaku has been at the centre of the pitch, talking to every Belgian player. Mm. And I think his connection with Martinez that they have had at Everton,
yes, that's
Lukaku
true.
Has become the voice to help... Right, there's a team talk, here are the tactics, and then Lukaku is tasked with that final hurdle, making sure players understand. He said after the Brazil game that he spoke to De Bruyne and Hazard, and he said, right, this is how Roberto wants us to play. I used to do this before. If you do this, we'll smash him. Mm-hmm. He said he only needed to explain it once, and they executed it because they're brilliant players. So, going back to what I expect, it will be Belgium trying to counter-attack as much as possible, France being a bit boring in possession because they're not that brilliant with it. They're not set up to be brilliant with it. But when Belgium do counter attack, it might be a sort of chain reaction. Mm. And the one space of the pitch where Belgium have looked weak is, or two spaces is the space behind the wing back and to the right of either or to the left of either centre back. Mm-hmm. And in Kylian Mbappe, France have potentially the best person to take advantage of that space. Against Argentina, what did Pogba do? Pick up the ball, clip it, two long channels, mm-hmm. and Mbappe, as we said before, retired Mascherano and got Rojo pulled off at half-time. So France will maybe want to encourage some counter-attacking so that there's space, but that's why it could be a really exciting game, because there's going to be such a dangerous line to cross, whether you invite too much pressure from France or you invite too many counterattacks. And then we could just get this end-to-end bonanza where Mbappe and Hazard are just running riot with each other.
I'd say there's certainly a lot of quality on show. I think Belgium have scored more goals than any other team in the World Cup, with 14. But France arguably had a slightly tougher route, just dogged route, getting past Uruguay and Argentina.
Well, I mean, Argentina were terrible.
Uruguay then.
This is the thing with France, right? And they've obviously got a lot of talent, and I hope they win. If England can't win the World Cup, I hope France do, because my son loves France. Here's the thing with France, right? Is that Deschamps, he plays down to the opposition. He did it in the Euros as well. He's gone back to this whole thing. He tried something different in the opening game, which was a really weird game to try out playing without Giroud, because surely Australia is the one team you want to play Giroud against. But you know, he tried it, didn't work, so he's gone back to type now. And then he's brought in Blaise Matuidi to be this third midfielder, play a quasi 4-3-3, 4-2-3-1 sort of formation. And it's what he did at the Euros with Moussa Sissoko. And he bored his way to the finals there. And then he ran out of they relied on luck. They rely on just the world-class talent that he has springing forth out of his defensive system. It's kind of Mourinho-esque, and then just winning the day, which is fine when your world-class talent is doing that. But sometimes the luck runs out. Euro 2016 final, the luck ran out. And they should have... Portugal were rubbish. France should have killed them, but France didn't. They were nowhere near. Portugal deserved to win that game. And you look at it, the World Cup so far, right? They played Australia. They were lucky. They got a lucky deflection on the Pogba shot to win that game, and a penalty that wasn't a penalty. Mm. Look at the Peru game. Lucky deflection on the Giroud shot to go over for Mbappe to score to win that game. Otherwise, they don't win that game.
Well, Giroud's shot was going in.
Well, yeah, right? Yeah. It was
not saved. I think that one in itself, you could argue that the game maybe they weren't brilliant, but the goal itself wasn't really lucky.
I suppose. And then they played the worst game of the tournament against Denmark. 0-0 draw. I mean, they played for it, but it was just awful. And then they played Argentina. Argentina are rubbish. I mean, they won the game, but they should have been. This is the thing I've always said about that game, is 4-3 and very exciting and Mbappe amazing, but they should have won that game at halftime. That should have been like 4-5-0 at halftime. But Deschamps was slow, didn't make the kind of changes he should have made. Should have immediately brought on Dembele or Nabil Fekir and hit them on the break repeatedly, because it was clear that wall was on every time, and he didn't do that. And then Uruguay, you know, no Cavani, injured for the first game. Yeah. Great set piece, I have to say. Great set piece. I love Griezmann's head of hesitation before sending in for Varane. They targeted Stuani, not Jimenez, and got in. They targeted Stuani. They worked. They got a goal. But then, you know, massive Muslera mistake. Literally 2 minutes after Uruguay had made some good changes to bring Maxi Gomez on to attack more. And so they got lucky again. And it's just, if Cavani plays that game, France don't win. You could see in the opening half, like, the amount of attacks Uruguay could fashion against the France midfield, against the French defence, by attacking the spaces behind the wingers, basically. Where, I mean, Kante can't cover everything, basically. And that, I mean, and it's,
he tries.
I was going to say, some would argue
he really tries. And I mean, I've said this before. It's almost like Deschamps, after winning the World Cup in 1998 and never getting the credit, despite being one of the key players of it, has set up his France team literally so N'Golo Kante has loads of balls to win back. Like, it's like the balls are constantly just being played out into positions where he has to contest with midfielders, and he's very good at that. But anyway, you look at how many times Uruguay could get the ball behind their midfield and actually start look like they're going to produce something, but then the ball would reach Stuani and break down. If Cavani was playing in that game, Uruguay win it. I'm almost certain of it. France, they've got immense talent, and they have enough talent to blow Belgium and England and Croatia out of the water. It's just, will Deschamps actually play that? I think, like Jake said, I think they'll probably encourage Belgium to have the ball, and they'll try and play for the break. And if they're smart, again, as Jake brought up brilliantly, that space where Mbappe plays is exactly the space they need to hit the ball long into. And Giroud, I think, will be a very good... He'll battle very well against Kompany and against Alderweireld. I think that's a really good matchup as well for France, because I think they're good, but he's just as good in the air. And Lukaku is... For me, he's the top-performing striker at the World Cup, to bring it back to Belgium. I mean, Kane has more goals, obviously, but Lukaku has played brilliantly. In the group stage, he scored 4 very nice goals. In the knockout rounds, he's been sensational. His off-the-ball movement has been outrageous. It's the whole thing, because he's always, he's Mr. Pace and Power, but he's played with incredible intelligence. And I mean, he always has. This is not like anything new, but it's just like, it's so starkly obvious. Like, anyone who, he's so impressive, right? And so he's been incredible. Belgium have a great chance, but I just think France... You know, with Griezmann playing reasonably well, Pogba's coming into his own very well. Kante's obviously having an amazing tournament. they could turn it on. But I think Belgium have, this is what I'm worried about for France, because Belgium have more of their key players in really good rhythm. France only really have Mbappe in good rhythm of their key forwards. Like, Griezmann is playing okay, but like, he's scoring penalties. Giroud is a good matchup theoretically, but he's not playing that well.
He hasn't scored yet.
Yeah, Matuidi is playing well, Pogba's playing well, and Mbappe's playing well, but you look at Belgium, Belgium are humming, right? And this is the thing with Belgium, just one more thing. The World Cup is just a run of seven games. Like, what was it? You know, it's seven games into the final. This is, the World Cup is just a run of seven games. What was Roberto Martinez excellent at with Wigan? Yeah. These 7 to 10 game runs at the end of every season, where they just win a bunch of games. Games you think,
same with the FA Cup win, I guess.
Yeah, and the FA Cup win as well. Just winning, win a bunch of games in a row that you'd never think this team could actually win, but they come together. The formation is tight. This is, it's the same formation, 3-4-2-1. And it comes together and it's tight, and they, the team fight for each other, and tactically they're so on point, and they just overrun teams. And this is what I'm worried about for France, because France objectively should beat Belgium, but Belgium have the momentum and they have this front three. Hazard is it's ridiculous. Who's gonna, how do you take 10 to 10 takers, man?
This is the thing. Rest in peace, Benjamin Pavard. Because that guy, as brilliant he has been, he is not fast. Yeah. And he's gangly and he's not very agile.
He's a centre back.
Yeah, exactly. He's a centre back. This is nothing negative about Benjamin Pavard at all. I think he's a brilliant player and I think he will be a brilliant centre back. But him playing right back against this little 5'8" wizard that can just literally receive the ball, shovel his shoulders someone on the floor. It was against that famous clip. Hazard against Zabaleta.
Yeah.
Where he just literally rocks from left to right.
And then Zabaleta's
full over. And Zabaleta looks like his groins have disintegrated. Like, Benjamin Pavard, for as good as he has been and scorer of a brilliant, brilliant goal, that is the matchup that Belgium need to exploit. Again, it's, you've got this completely agile, brilliant dribbler against a less mobile than your average right back.
Because Lucas Hernandez, another flank, actually, unlike Marcelo, Lucas Hernandez actually is well set up to not handle Lukaku, but like he could battle Lukaku much better. Like, the reason he made that change against Brazil, Martinez, is because obviously Marcelo's going to just hurl up the field. There's going to be a huge gap there, and Brazil's centre backs are not fast. So he's like, hey, Romelu, just run in there, mate. And he killed them against France. I do think, I agree with you, I think he'll stick with that. I don't think he'll move Lukaku back into the middle, but I just think all the three of France's back four are very well set up to deal with Lukaku. They can match him athletically and they can match him intelligently and tactically and all that stuff. Umtiti's phenomenal, Varane is phenomenal, and Lucas Hernandez is not quite as known as those two, but he will also one day be seen as phenomenal. So I think, but it's
certainly one to look forward to. And yeah, Peter, I don't know what the match odds for this one, who's favourites, and what you're expecting from the match in general. As the guys say, there's obviously lots of talent on show, and it could be one of the better semi-finals sort of in World Cup history, potentially.
Yeah, absolutely buzzing for this one. Latest BetBright odds, we have France at 7-5. We've got 11-5 for the draw, and Belgium 21-10 going into the first semi-final this week. It's going to be a very close game, and I think we'll need more than 90 minutes to split the two of them.
That's a good
shout. If we do go into extra time and penalties to qualify, we've got Belgium at 21-20 and France 3-4. Again, very, very close. In terms of now, this is all in theoretics, and if we get there, of course, to the final, beating Croatia, in terms of who we'd rather play, I think in terms of the quality, as the betting suggests, and as we've seen, both teams are similar enough. Obviously, the way in which Belgium beat Brazil very impressively, that's to be taken into account. So they'll go into this with a lot of confidence as well, I think. But if I had a gun to my head, I think I'd rather be playing France in the final. But that's a very, it's a very fine line between them.
If I would agree with that, mate. I would say if you're England, you want to play France, because Belgium, they've got too many players who know the England players inside out. And also, England have struggled historically under Southgate against teams that match formation, and Belgium has the same formation. Mm. And this is the worry that. That they'll come at England with the same formation, but with better players in that front three.
Yeah,
and that's the big worry, that it would just overrun England with quality. France, obviously, phenomenal side, but they've got a lot of issues. France, and you'd back England to sort of, I mean, look, let's beat Croatia first, but you can see how England would fare better against France than against Belgium. I think
the one thing that gets slightly overlooked with that Belgium display, obviously, the first half they just blitzed Brazil and it was sort of perfect, execute the plan perfectly, as I said. In the second half, again, quality of shot matters, but they had one shot compared to Brazil's 17. They almost retreated too far back into this tactic, and it was they became too deep that they couldn't even spring these counterattacks by the end of it. So Martinez, he didn't get the balance wrong. They won the game, and obviously you're going to get nervous. There's huge amounts of pressure on this Belgium team, as there is on the England one. I think there are parallels there in the fact that maybe England's 2020, as we said earlier, that could be the time that happens. But there's a lot of pressure on this Belgian team, and Martinez gets criticised a lot, and rightly at times. But he got his tactics right, but they almost sort of went too within themselves. And giving 17 shots away to someone, I think Belgium have also faced the most shots in the World Cup. So that they are winning, but they are also giving teams chance to win. As we said, they're scoring a lot of goals. They've got a brilliant front three, but if you've got a good front three and England have some very good attacking talent, then there are, again, I've said England there, like France have some very good attacking talent, and they will get chances. And then if Griezmann as well is as ice cool composed as he is usually, Giroud hasn't scored yet, so I expect him to have a brilliant game. And then you've got Mbappe, who's chasing this sort of six goal teenage tally that Pelé produced in 1958. So although Belgium did look good against Brazil, and as I said, they executed perfectly for a period rather than 90 minutes, and letting someone have 17 shots, as we've seen with Griezmann's effort against Muslera, that was not a threatening shot, but when you keep, if you give enough away, one of them might go in.
Absolutely. And just rounding up a little bit on sort of looking back at the tournament as a whole, we've got a question in from at Selwy on Twitter. Yeah. Linked to what we've been talking about, to be fair. He said, can anyone compete with Hazard for the player of the tournament? And basically, if there's anyone outside
Jesse
of that.
Jesse Lingard. That's who.
No. Linking to that, anyone unlikely that might be in contention.
Jesse Lingard, yeah. No, look, I think you look at the Golden Ball, the amusing thing, Jake and I were discussing this before the pod, is all the favourites for the Golden Ball went out the quarterfinal stage. Diego got in, Philippe Coutinho and Isco were the three outstanding players at the tournament, in my opinion. I'm up to the quarterfinal. And Godin was excellent in the quarterfinal as well. Coutinho and Isco less so. I mean, there was Coutinho still produced that great assist, but he didn't play. He missed that great chance, and Isco was just kind of played well on the ball, but was kind of all over the place positionally. We've been all over that before. You know, so those three were the still ones. But of those three, only Godin you could say still kind of has a shout, but not really. Who's going to emerge from this slot? I mean, you look at Modric and Rakitic, world class midfielders. They've had very good tournaments. If they do something crazy, I mean, you know, King Kylian. I mean. This is the thing. If you know, golden balls are decided, I would argue, from the semis and finals onwards.
It's decisive now, isn't it?
I mean, you know, unless someone was... I mean, look at the World Cup 2014. James Rodriguez was the outstanding offensive player at the tournament. Didn't win the golden ball because he got out in the quarterfinals. And, you know, defensive players like Kante's been excellent. But I don't think... Look, Mascherano was the best player in 2014 at the tournament, right? Better than Neuer, better than Kroos, better than everyone. He's a defensive midfielder. He's not going to win the golden ball. Kante is probably one of the best players so far. He's not going to win the golden ball. He's a defensive midfielder. Pogba and Lingard are my, you know, the ex Man United Milk Cup winning teammates. I would say they're my outside shouts because neither of them have had like, oh my God, amazing tournaments. But no one has really that's still currently playing. But they've both been very good tactically. They've both come up big for their team in terms of execution, especially Pogba. And they're fun to watch.
And Peter, I mean, I suppose Harry Kane's got to be mentioned, hasn't he? If he scores 9 goals and England win the World Cup, I mean, how can you get past him?
I think he'd get more than the golden ball, only get the knighthood if that happens.
That's very true.
Harry Kane and Mbappe are joint favourites for the golden ball. Bet 7-2, you can get them as it stands now. And Mitchell Paul Pogba there, 33-1, and Kante, 33-1. I think they're probably fair prices. I think you're right. As the tournament progresses and the players start to shine through, I think if we have a standout performance from Mbappe and France do go through, that price will shorten quite significantly as well. I think he'll continue to gain momentum, perform, you know, in terms of levels that we've not seen from him before. Eden Hazard, an interesting one. Sorry, 5-1. I think in terms of, you know, if you'd have thrown this name out there at the start of the tournament, people would have added a few eyelids. We've got Luka Modric in there, who's 7-1. Now, depending how this week's game against England goes for Croatia, I think, again, if we see against England I think Luka Modric could well be in there as well if he takes Croatia all the way to the final. Even if they don't win the final, I think that would have been some standout performance from a very, very good Croatian player, Modric.
Do you agree with that, Jake?
Yeah. I just wanted to say that if I was going to say who I think is actually, say the voting was going over the tournament, I think Luka Modric's picked up the most Man of the Match awards. And I just want to say I don't necessarily agree with that. But if you look at what a general sort of overview of how people on the outside are looking at the tournament, mm-hmm. three Man of the Match awards, Croatia in a semi-final. If the Golden Ball was awarded now, I genuinely think Luka Modric would be the one to win it. Mm. These semi-finals, as we just said, will define, I think, who wins it. And I think it will come from this pool of four teams. And if you look at sort of three or four contenders from each nation, Belgium, you've got the front three, as we've mentioned. And at the moment, I think Eden Hazard is the sort of sexiest choice for them to win. And I'd say he was my... If Belgium won, I think Hazard would pick it up.
Yeah, definitely.
England, you've got Harry Kane scoring goals. And I think that means that they'll look to give it to someone else. Mm. He should pick up the Golden Boot.
Yeah.
And they very rarely give the award to,
unless
to
it's,
two players.
Unless it's like Ronaldo, unless it's like someone just who's obviously like... Kane hasn't really played well in the tournament. Yeah. He's scored goals and done very well, but I don't think he's played well.
I think he's sort of... He's not the all-conquering forward that we see for Spurs, and it's by design. It's nothing against Harry Kane. Against Colombia was a brilliant target man display.
I think he's kind of hurt. I don't think he's 100% fit either. I think he's clearly carrying something.
So from England, Kane will be part of it. As I said, he's joint favourite because of the goals he's scoring. Kieran Trippier has actually been incredible. Mm. He's created the most chances of any defender, most of them from set pieces, but winning a Golden Ball on set piece delivery alone, if it's good enough, should be a thing.
You're claiming the Barry Beckham thing, by the way.
I was covering that game and I was just absolutely peddling a Barry Beck's agenda, and it's now a common nickname for Trippier. So
influencer, mate. I'll
TM that one. But yeah, so I think Trippier, Lingard, as Mo mentioned, has a case. He was very good against Sweden. Needs to repeat that to be in with a chance. And then you could either argue Stones and Maguire for England, even Pickford if he has more saves. So England is sort of not the clearest pool. And then France, you've got Mbappe, Kante and Griezmann, in my opinion. Pogba as well could make a late emergence. So, and Croatia, as I said, Modric would be my favourite now. Rakitic has scored two winning penalties. If he starts to play better than Modric, if Croatia go far, then he could pip it. Or you've got Subasic in goal, who, as we mentioned, is nearly breaking penalty shootout records.
So, if another penalty shootout win, and surely...
Yeah, if Croatia got to the final, say, by winning four penalty shootouts, and Subasic had saved two penalties each of them, I don't think Oliver Kahn was the last goalkeeper to win Golden Ball and Golden Glove in 2002. So there's precedent for it to happen, and you can't argue. If someone's literally winning you penalty shootouts by saving penalties, then I think he should deserve it. But at the moment, Modric is probably there, Hazard second, or any of Belgium's front three sort of second, and then I'm not really sure about England's yet.
They'd have to win it, wouldn't they?
Yeah, England would have to win it, and I personally at the moment would lean towards Trippier more than anyone in terms of a Golden Ball, because Kane will get the Golden Boot.
Absolutely. And just rounding up this section, actually, there's obviously been a bit of fallout already from the World Cup. It's a strange situation for Spain, wasn't it? Because Fernando Herrera took over about 10 minutes before kickoff, didn't he, in the first game?
Basically, it was like Julian Lopetegui didn't have the sense to say to Real Madrid, look, can you just wait to appoint me boss, like, until after the tournament? Like, he signed the contract before the tournament, and then, of course, once it's signed it has to come out at some point, and they chose the worst time to make it come out. They didn't negotiate with the Spain Federation, which was really unprofessional, and then the new boss, Rubiales, he got offended, rightfully so, I would say, and then took a decision which, in hindsight, was terrible. At the time, though, I saw what he was trying to do, and he sacked Lopetegui. Look, ultimately, if Lopetegui had said, look, Real Madrid, I will be your boss, but you know what? Verbally, I'm not signing anything till after the tournament. I'm sorry, you have to wait. Spain would have won the World Cup. I'm not even exaggerating. I think they had the best defence, best goalkeeper, best midfield coming into the tournament. Costa was in good form, as we saw eventually. I think you saw how good they were in the opening game. The longer they got, they played with Hierro, they got worse. If they'd be playing at that level, the opening game level, the whole tournament, they would have won the thing easily. But, I mean, that's the breaks, isn't it?
Who should replace him?
I mean, look, the Spanish Federation want Marcelino or Roberto Martinez, but having just thrown a massive hissy fit over Real Madrid poaching their under-contract manager, they don't kind of then want to go take Valencia or Belgium's manager. So it'll be Luis Enrique, probably. I think everyone's talking about that. That's a good shout, I think. That's a very good shout. For Luis Enrique, he's got a lot of interest outside football, loves doing Ironman stuff, cycling, very, very big into fitness, so he can still
international football would suit him.
Yeah, so he can do that as international football, and he can come in doesn't have to go through the grind every day of managing, which I think never appealed to him. Like, in the same way that it clearly appeals to Pep Guardiola, I don't think it appealed to Luis Enrique. And I think he can take a more relaxed role. And of course, fitness is a big part of the way he manages things. It's not tactics so much, it's more fitness and mentality. Mm-hmm. And that is really international football. You don't have enough time to implement heavy tactics unless you're like Jorge Sampaoli and you literally organise like 2-week long training camps for your teams. You don't have enough time, which is what he did with Chile, by the way, which is why they won stuff with Chile. He didn't do it with Argentina and they looked terrible. So mm-hmm. There you go. It's fitness and it's motivation. He's an excellent motivator. He's an excellent fitness freak. So it would suit Spain. It would really suit Spain. And also having a Barcelona legend counteracting how many Real Madrid players are basically in the squad would sort of help the politics of the situation. No, he did. But I mean, you know, but yeah, he's identified more with Barcelona, which I think
he's the perfect man because he's played for both.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And he knows how to handle diplomacy. I think if the worry would have been if you'd hired someone who from the Real Madrid pool, as it were, then it's like the squad is already full of Real Madrid players. They just signed Alvaro Odriozola. So now literally three of the back four could be Real Madrid players if you play Nacho next to Ramos. Like, yeah, that's a lot. And then there's forwards, Risco. There's a lot of young Spanish Real Madrid players.
Certainly a lot of good happened. But to be honest, at the moment, who cares too much? Because it's the two semi-finals we're looking forward to, isn't it? And beyond that, there's going to be all sorts of things happening.
Yeah, just look out for Spain Euro 2020 maybe. But yeah. I mean, until then,
I saw some shouts about them looking at Rafa Benitez as well.
Oh, really? Mate, that would be dicey.
I don't personally agree with that will happen, but there's sort of a pool of managers. There's also the Real Betis coach, Kike Setién, that has been like playing really entertaining.
Gareth Southgate, surely.
Yeah, it's been in demand after this. Exactly, yeah.
Looking forward to the two semi-finals and what happens with Spain, we'll wait and see.
Yeah.
Okay, next up. So we've got a topic away from the World Cup, but one that's sort of too big to ignore, really. Ronaldo to Juventus, reported £88 million fee. Mm-hmm. If that happens, Mo, is it good value? Because I think, I mean, since turning 30, 3 and a bit years ago, he's won 3 Champions League trophies, 2 Ballon d'Ors. Yeah. You would suggest that, you know, he's still worth a lot of money.
I mean, look, it's one of those rare deals where this is good value for everyone. I would argue £88 million for a 33-year-old is objectively too much money, but you look at the subjective elements of it.
It's not just any 33-year-old, is it?
No, it's not even that. It's like what Juventus, and even if it's Cristiano, I would say any other team, but what Juventus needs specifically and what it needs, everyone wins, right? Madrid can have their new era, right? And you feel like they've been building for this, by the way. I'll get into that later, but Madrid get the new era. They get to build the new era around Isco, right? And then you look at you look, Juve, they get their superstar. They get their you know, this world-class forward, elite forward. I mean, if he's still world-class consistently, whatever. The guy produces on the big stage.
He is world-class.
Yes. Yeah, you know, I mean, consistently. Do you know what I mean? Like, he was rubbish for half of last season, for instance. But they get this guy who can impact the biggest games, the biggest stages, and they want to win the Champions League. And they've signed Mr. Champions League. I mean, I think...
Do you think Buffon's annoyed that he's moved on and they signed Ronaldo?
I mean, but also at the same time, to be fair, like, Buffon was clearly... should have been nowhere near their team last season. I love Buffon, but he was... The most notable thing he did in the Champions League last year was get sent off. Like, look, they want to sign the Champions League. They want to win the Champions League. They signed Mr. Champions League. This guy owns literally every... I'm pretty sure it is literally every record going in the Champions League as a goal scoring. That's what he's made for, man. And now they can rest him, rotate him. And for Ronaldo, it's great for him because he gets to go to a league where there's no one better than him, which was his big problem in Spain. And he gets to win league titles. The man has won 2 league titles in Spain in 9 years. That's not a good ratio turn for a player that good. Now he gets to go there and basically monopolize the league title, which is good for him. And he probably could even try and win a Champions League. So now he can maybe go... Maybe, let's just put it out there, this could be Ronaldo's first treble. He didn't have one. He missed out on one at United because of Portsmouth. Never got really close to one in Madrid. Could he get his first treble with Juve? I mean, you wouldn't put it past him, would you?
You certainly wouldn't. I mean, he's got a lot in the locker. Yeah. I mean, Jake, how do you think it will sort of affect La Liga in general and sort of Real Madrid and Barcelona? And will Messi be pleased he's gone or annoyed that he's gone? What do you think?
I don't think really annoyed or pleased anyone. As Mo said, it gives Real Madrid an excuse to start build their new future. They've got a lot of young Spanish players. They've just hired the ex-Spain under-21 and Spain coach. So I think they're going to go for a very sort of nationalised team sort of thing. It'll be very Spanish heavy again. So it gives them a chance to do that. But it's not really a negative for La Liga. As you said, they'll still have Lionel Messi. I think more so it's a massive positive for Serie A, which has sort of got a lesser reputation than it used to have. They finally get one of those massive marquee signings again, and And as Mo was speaking about the Champions League, if an Italian side can win the Champions League, that again, it breaks that monopoly of the last sort of a Liga side have won like the last 8 out of 10 European trophies, including Europa League. So it gives Juventus a chance to sort of break that, and they bought the player to do it. He's the only player to score 10 Champions League goals against a single opponent. That's against Juventus. So they bought him. He's the first player to score 100 goals, the first player to win 100 games in sort of the Champions League era. As Mo said, there's every stat that you want about it. He is the one person you'd buy if you want to win the Champions League, because he scores goals, and at 33 years old, although his role has completely changed, he's now scoring more than ever. And if there are rumours about Higuain going to Chelsea and stuff like that, so they lose sort of that goal scorer. But if you just plonk Cristiano Ronaldo up front in the box, let him do what he does best, you've got Paulo Dybala, who wants to become sort of the next great sort of playmaking false striker. He's scored lots of goals last season, but he's very much scores from outside the box. They're all special goals rather than complete goal scorer. Then you've got Douglas Costa, who's one of my favourite wingers in world football at the moment. And then you've got sort of, you can use Mandzukic to back him up. As Mo said, Mandzukic doesn't even play up front anymore. You'll have that double aerial threat of Pjanic whipping in set pieces to Mandzukic and Ronaldo. They'll score goals every sort of way if they sign him. And just in terms of his age, the last 50 goals he scored for club and country was the fourth fastest half century he's managed. This is a guy with over 600 goals. So there's a lot of half centuries there. It's not just, it's not just, oh, this is his second. So he's scoring at a rate that's nearly, when he was in his prime, he's nearly matching that at 33 years old. Serie A, obviously, it's meant to be a slower game, and Juventus will very much play to his strength. So agree with Mo, for all involved, I think it's a positive deal.
Yeah, I mean, you look at I mentioned Mandzukic earlier, Jake brought it up there. Mandzukic is at his best when there's someone playing off him for the team. And so now Higuain's gone, right? They're going to get rid of him. Poor Higuain got run out of Madrid by Ronaldo. He's getting run out of Turin by Ronaldo. and Ronaldo's going to break his Capo Cannonieri record as well, 36 goals. Sorry,
Higuain. Guy.
Sorry, Pepito. Well, Higuain deserves it for those three misses in the executive finals. But no. Listen, it's Mandzukic. Now you can play him on left, but you can play him up front now. You can play Cristiano off him in a 4-2-3-1. You could play 3-4-2-1 or whatever and play Dybala and Cristiano off Mandzukic, and Dybala is your playmaker, Mandzukic is your target man who does a lot of the work that Benzema does for Real Madrid, that makes Cristiano shine, that lets him just sort of run into these positions, because Mandzukic can do that. And then you've got Cristiano, who's just going to score so many goals. This is the thing we watched for Real Madrid last season, is that the way they set up, it was all to provide him a chance to score goals. And when he hit that vein of form, like, he was, until January or late December, early December, he was really poor. And then suddenly he hit that vein of form, and that was it. And he was gone. And like Jake says, fastest half century. Because it's just, you watch the second half, he scored, 40-something goals last season. Not literally all of them, but almost all of them were in the second half of the season. Like, he had like 10 goals at halfway.
Apart from his Champions League.
Like,
goals.
At one point, he had a 4% shot conversion in La Liga because he only scored 2 goals from like over 100 shots. The guy is incredible, and I think it's such an exciting move as well, because it allows Madrid to move into their new direction. I can't wait to watch Madrid now, because Lopetegui loves Isco. Right, and the one thing they were going to have was, how are you going to put Isco and Cristiano into the same side, except for you play the diamond, and Lopetegui likes to play 4-3-3 and likes to play Isco as a forward. So now what you're going to get is, you're going to get 4-3-3, Isco as a left forward. You're probably going to get Dani Ceballos or Toni Kroos playing in that left midfield role, playing behind Isco. You're going to get a lot of really good stuff. All Real Madrid need now is a striker. And unfortunately for Tottenham Hotspur, they have a very good one. So
maybe that's one for another podcast. I think we can talk about that loads. Peter, are you a fan of Ronaldo? And do you think he'll obviously do well in Italy?
Yeah, he really, really blew me away, actually, during his time in the World Cup. It's a shame that his sort of Portugal side weren't up to his standards or anywhere near his standards. It would have been good to see how he could potentially have made this tournament his own. I think 88 million is a fair price for him. As you say, he's not any old 33-year-old. He's sort of been there and done it in Spain. So I think he's one of those players that wants to keep testing himself, and he want to prove that he can do it in another league, in another country. I think it'd be a good move for him. And I think it'll also open a few more doors for players like, as you say, Isco, and possibly, if the rumours are true about Real Madrid showing an interest in Mbappe, I'm not sure how true those rumours are. But I think obviously, and probably rightly so, Ronaldo has a huge presence at any club or team he plays in. So I think if he does go to Juventus, which it looks like he will, I think that will make a sort of nice vacation for or vacancy for a you know, younger star to come through, and potentially for Madrid to kind of express themselves as a team rather than sort of a Ronaldo and the rest. In terms of La Liga as well, I think we'll now see Real Madrid v Barcelona rather than the kind of normal comparisons being made between Messi and Ronaldo. So I think it's probably a good move for both parties, all three parties, in terms of Juventus, Ronaldo and Real Madrid, if the move goes ahead. But yeah, I'm a massive fan of him, and the longer he can kind of maintain this kind of progression and freakish monster-like playing style he has, the better for the world of football, really.
Absolutely, it's only going to be fascinating over the next few months if it goes ahead, and sort of the implications on the sort of all involved parties. We mentioned Barcelona just very briefly. There's been a transfer that caught my eye. It was yesterday or today. Plinio has gone back to, was it Guangzhou Evergrande?
Guangzhou Evergrande, yeah.
After 1 year at Barcelona, that's a strange one, right?
Yeah, that's very strange. Basically, you know, it's you look at it, when they signed him, it was strange anyway, because everyone was like, what, this guy? Because his profile, I think he's fantastic, by the way, but his profile is completely the opposite of a Barcelona midfielder. His close control is non-existent. He takes about 5 yards to get moving. He's a great goal scorer. He's a great physical player. He moves forward very well. Excellent forward movement. Kind of like a Brazilian Lampard. But never developed the sort of close control game that Lampard eventually developed after working for years at Chelsea with Makélélé and so on, and Ballack and that lot. And it's just, it was so weird, but he played very well. He came in for Barcelona and he left his very cushy life in China, which, I mean, everyone says, oh, I put paper, he could have stayed in China. He's making a lot of money. He came to Barcelona, took a risk. Barcelona in a bad shape, and he played brilliantly. Mm. He was really important for them. He won them big points in the first half of the season. He only dropped off second half because he was so tired, having played already since the start of 2017 with Guangzhou in China. He's been playing for like a full year. He never had a break, so he was a bit tired, but not as good as second half season, but still had a good season. Going back to, why would they sell him? Well, there's two prevailing thoughts. One is the whole thing was a PR stunt for Guangzhou Evergrande. It was like, let's buy the player. Look, our players are good enough to play for Barcelona, sort of thing. Mm. You know, and it's like, and that's why they're buying him back at a profit, because it was like, can you, you know, buy our player as PR for the Chinese league? Yeah. And it's like, and now we're going to take him back. And then the other preventive thing, which I think is what it is Barcelona need to free up two non-EU spots in their squad, because they want to sign. They're bringing in Arthur from Brazil, a young midfielder, very very good, very young passing midfielder, and they are also being linked with either Willian or Hervin Lozano to be their left winger, to be their Griezmann replacement, effectively. Mm. And they're both non-EU players, and Barcelona are at their limit of non-EU spots. Now, right, they're going to sell Yerry Mina, the Colombian defender, because he's not, doesn't really fit their style. And I love Yerry Mina, but I think he would do better in a side that's more orthodox. And so then they still need one more free EU spot. Paulinho is a non-EU player. You sell him back to Guangzhou Evergrande. And, you know, you make 10 million profit, or you will make 10 million profit if they execute the buy clause, which I think they will. And then you make 10 million profit on a player, and you free up your two EU slots that you need.
So it does make more sense when you look at it overall.
Yeah, it makes sense. The only really odd thing about it is that Barcelona, so Guangzhou went ahead and announced it about 3 hours before Barcelona, and usually it's a very mutual thing. And Barcelona's initial statement said that they've reached an agreement for the loan transfer of Paulinho for one season with a mandatory purchase option for the Chinese club. We covered that news and sorted that out and thought, right, this is it. Guangzhou left that out because they obviously weren't sure, just didn't want to mention it. Barcelona said, right, this is mandatory. They had the word mandatory and obligation in it four times. 30 minutes later, that had all been changed, all that documentation, and now it's only an option to buy. Whether, obviously, it's not a mandatory option, and as Mo said, I expect them to execute it, but it's just, there's something weird about this transfer that sort of, the language of it is, it keeps changing, and no one's sure exactly what the deal is. All it is that Paulinho's gone back, and as Mo said, it's most likely because, although he was their third top scorer in La Liga last season, they've got Coutinho, who is a much better midfielder if he plays, and they also want to bring in more South American or non-EU players that are objectively better than Paulinho. So again, like the Ronaldo transfer, it's a win-win for everyone. Mm. He won two trophies at Barcelona, scored 9 goals, enhanced his reputation, enhanced China's reputation. Barcelona didn't get a bad player. But now they're like, okay, that's fine. You can go back now.
Paulinho has won four league titles in 3 years since he left Spurs. His 2 years at Spurs are the only years since 2010 where he hasn't won a title. He's won a title in every year since then. 2011, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, and 18.
Impressive.
Well, except, no, sorry, not 14, 15. He was at Spurs. But, you know, when he wasn't at Spurs, he was winning titles. So he's a great player, and I wish him nothing but luck. I think he's quite a unique talent, you know, very underrated player. His Players Tribune piece was very nice. He's a good guy. Good luck to him.
And certainly there'll be lots of transfer stuff to discuss in the next few weeks.
So much more.
And it's such a small window for them to buy players after the World Cup as well.
That's going to be so exciting.
It's going to be chaos. But we will make the last word on the World Cup because that's what the semi-finals coming up.
Yeah.
Peter, I'll give you the last word, mate. What are you expecting the next few days? Looking forward to it?
We've got some cracking games, haven't we? Who would have thought of England 5-2, second favourites, with two wins away from being world champions? We wouldn't have thought that 3 or 4 weeks ago. So yeah, can't wait. Got two fantastic competitive semi-finals to come. Obviously, you can get all your latest odds over at betbright.com for the World Cup. And yeah, it's going to be fantastic. Can't wait.
Okay, good stuff. That's just about all we've got time for this week. Thanks to Mo, as always.
Thanks to you, Thomas. It's been an absolute pleasure, mate. I love the World Cup. Can't wait for it to... Oh, it's going to finish, isn't it?
I'm
depressed now.
Jake, thanks very much, mate.
Well, I'm not going to follow that, am I? Thank you for having me. It was fun.
And once again, thanks to Peter. We'll speak to you again next time, mate.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, guys. Come on, England.
Come on, England. Let's do it.